Let's get started. So what we're gonna do this week is we are gonna finish up last few things that we didn't get to last week in diaspora communities. Last week we spent a lot of time on Babylonia. This week we're going to be talking about a few little smaller communities that also come up in the Mishnah and the Gemara. And then we're going to be moving on to money, right? Money makes the world go round. Money and how people made their money. We'll see how far we get. We might get into professions, we might not, but we'll definitely get to talk a little bit about money. What we are looking at here is a coin hoard from underneath a synagogue called Wadi Hammam, near the Kinneret, near the Sea of Galilee. A synagogue that's only been discovered recently and been researched recently. We are going to talk about coin hoards a little bit later and what that means and what is their significance, but this was just a really nice picture of money, so that's why I put it in. Okay. Here we go. Yeah, sources are in the chat for people who need them. And Susanna's going to post them again in another couple of minutes if you didn't see them. Okay. Two communities that we're going to talk a little bit about in a place called Asia Minor. Today we don't really think about Asia Minor. It's more or less northern Syria, Turkey, right? You can see it on this map. We are going to talk, this was a very
I'm not seeing your
important
share
area.
screen, Shuli. Is anyone else
What?
not? I'm not seeing the share screen at all. Is anyone else not seeing
I see it.
I see it.
I see
Very
it. I
strange.
see it.
That
See,
might
Bob? I
be
see it.
personal computer. Maybe go out and come back in. That would be my suggestion. That's usually my
All right.
suggestion. Turn
I will
off
try
your
it.
appliance
When
and
all
try
else
it again.
fails, reboot.
Okay.
Yeah, got it. Okay.
Yes. Okay, so we're going to talk about two different places. Asia Minor, usually mostly under the control of the Romans, although on this kind of border area could be fought over between the Romans and the Parthians, later the Sasanians. We're going to talk about two places, Tarsus or Tarshish or Tarsim. Okay, maybe that, maybe not. And Cappadocia or Kapotikia, as it is in the Gemara. Okay, Tarsium are the stranger ones, right? The more complicated ones. The Gemara has a few different statements about a group, we'll call it that, called the Tarsium. And it's unclear, are they an occupation? Are they a place? Okay, we have a few mentions of the Beit Knesset shel ha-Tarsium, the synagogue of the Tarsium. Okay, if you look at the top source here in the Gemara and Nazir, right, sounds kind of ghoulish. An incident occurred in which they brought a box full of bones to the synagogue of Tarsium. We're not going to talk about the box of bones, but what is this story? What does this mean? The synagogue of Tarsium. So we might say, okay, it's a synagogue like we know. We have references to the synagogue of the Babylonians or the Alexandrians, right? That even not in those places, right? We have another reference to this same synagogue of Tarsium, and it seems it's in the city of Lud in the land of Israel. Okay, that's not such a strange idea. Walk around Nachlaot in Jerusalem today, and you'll see synagogues of the Jews from Greece and the Jews from Iraq and the Jews from Iraq, all over the place, right? So that's an interesting possibility. However, okay, here we had the source last time we talked about the synagogue in Alexandria. We talked about the occupations, and each occupation in this massive synagogue would sit by themselves, right? The goldsmiths and the silversmiths and the blacksmiths, the Tarsiim and the Gardiim. Wait a second, right? Is this an ethnicity, a nationality, or maybe it's an occupation, okay? And we have a few other places where they seem to be an occupation. Tosfot in the Gemara Avodah Zarah lists the various places we hear about these guys called Tarsiim. It seems in some sources they're weavers, in other sources they're metal workers. Not so clear, right? Then we have a Gemara about two people who are pretty well known, right? Megillat Esther, and that's Bigdan and Teresh. Remember them, right? And Rabbi Yochanan says, who are these guys? Bigdan and Teresh were two Tarsians, and they would talk in the Tarsian language. Okay, now we're definitely not talking about an occupation, but a nationality. They did not know that Mordechai was one of those who sat in Sanhedrin, which convened in the chamber of hewn stone, that he knew 70 languages. Okay, so not so clear, right? And where would this place be if it is a place? Now you might remember then the book of Jonah, right? You'd say for Jonah, he escapes to where? Tarshish, which seems like the furthest possible place from where he's supposed to go, which is Nineveh. And that's why some people say it's Spain. Okay. It could be our Tarshish, or it could be a place called Tarsus, which is what you're seeing here, right in the Mediterranean, right? The southern part of Asia Minor, not all that far from the land of Israel. Here is the area of Phoenicia, right? Sor and Sidon. And here we're going down towards the coast of Eretz Yisrael, right? Tarsus is definitely better known to Christians than to Jews because probably the most famous Christian, except for Jesus, is a guy named Saul of Tarsus, right? Saul, who has this revelation and he takes a new name and he becomes Paul. And he essentially is the guy who creates Christianity as we know it today. Okay. So he's a very interesting guy. Is this our Tarsus? Maybe. Is this our Tarsium? Could it be that the Tarsium are both an occupation and a nationality? Yes, right? Sometimes nationalities are associated with certain types of work, right? If you came to the land of Israel 100, 120 years ago, Yemenites, right? Yemenite Jews, or if you went to Yemen, a lot of them were silversmiths, right? Talk about a Yemenite Jew you met that was a silversmith. So it could be that you're both. It's not so clear in the Gemara, but it's interesting to think about. Hey, much clearer is this place called Kapotkia or Cappadocia. Okay, it's a place where diaspora Jews definitely lived. It's mentioned occasionally at the rabbis' travel there. I'll just brought you two sources here, right? When the Mishnah in Shabbos talks about what oil is good for the Beit Ham is good for, sorry, is good for Shabbat candles, right? You have different opinions. Rabbi Tarfon says only olive oil, only Shemen Zayit. And then we have a protest, right? Another rabbi gets up and says, and this is in the Tosefta, what about the Babylonians? They don't grow olives. They only have sesame oil. What about the Mandaim? Only have nut oil. Alexandrians only have radish oil. And the people of Cappadocia who have none of those, right? What did they use for oil? Good question, right? But it shows you there's a Jewish community there, right? There's definitely a Jewish community there. We have rabbis who travel there, right? Great story that we have here in Yevamot, coming to prove that you can't assume that someone is necessarily dead in a sea that has no end. That's the Yevamos talks about. It's something that's unfortunately still relevant today. We've talked about a lot during 9/11. How do we know that we can prove that someone is dead? So this is a very important discussion in Yevamot. Rabbi Akiva says, once I was traveling on a boat and I saw a certain boat sinking at sea, and I was grieved over the apparent death of the Torah scholar who was on board. Who was that? Rabbi Meir. But when I disembarked at the province of Cappadocia, he came and sat and deliberated before me about halacha. I said to him, my son, who brought you up from the water? He said to me, one wave carried me to another and another to another until I reached the shore, and a wave cast me up onto dry land, right? It's a beautiful story. You can think of it on a metaphorical level also, but it tells us that the rabbis travel to Cappadocia. Jews from Cappadocia travel to the land of Israel. It's definitely not one of the major Jewish communities, but a Jewish community in the diaspora. Okay, so we're done with these guys, and we are going to move on to not a specific place, but something that's very intriguing. Okay, a few places in the Gemara, we hear about something called Medinat Hayam. Okay, now Medinat Hayam seems like this. In Hebrew, we have a phrase, me'ever lahareh choshech, over the hills of darkness, right? The ends of the earth, the farthest place you can imagine. We're going to see in a minute that there's even a further place. But this Medinat Hayam, it's vague what it is. It seems to be far away. We'll get to various possibilities in a minute. But first, let's understand the idea of the sea, okay? The rabbis know about the sea. The rabbis travel on the sea. We have a few stories about rabbis on boats. We know that there are Jews who were sailors. We get to our professions at the end of this class, or maybe next class, we'll hear about sailors. And there are even Jews who own fleets of ships. Okay, if you look at the picture here on the bottom left, This is, it's very faint. It's hard to see, but you should be able to make out some black lines. And this is a drawing of a ship, and it was discovered on the walls of a tomb in Jerusalem, in the middle of the Rehavia neighborhood in Jerusalem. It's called Jason's Tomb. Clearly some very wealthy guy who built a family tomb, and he put a ship as the decoration on the wall. Was he a ship owner? Did he want to have a ship? Did he like sailing? We don't know. But Jews are familiar with ships. They're familiar with the sea. We have a lot of stories about rabbis traveling on ships. I only brought you two here, right? Great one, the Gemara in Sukkah. There was an incident involving Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Akiva who were coming on a ship. Rabbi Akiva arose and established a sukkah at the top of the ship, right? This discussion, where can you build a sukkah? The next day, the wind blew and uprooted it. Rabban Gamliel said to him, Akiva, where's your sukkah? Right? What happened to your sukkah? Hey, maybe it's not such a good idea. It's not so stable to put it on the deck of the ship. Right? Another story, the same generation, same time period. Rabban Gamliel, and this is part of the whole story of Rabban Gamliel, who is putting Rabbi Elazar HaGadol, Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus into Cheirem for not following majority rule. And the Gemara talks about how Rabbi Elazar was such a great man that his emotional distress actually caused changes in the world, right? And brought this huge storm. And Rabban Gamliel was coming on a boat at the time, and a large wave swelled over him and threatened to drown him. Rabban Gamliel said, it seems to me this is only for the sake of Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus. Rabban Gamliel stood on his feet and said, Master of the universe, it is revealed and known before you that neither was it for my honor that I acted, nor the honor of the house of my father. Rather, it was for your honor, so that disputes will not proliferate in Israel. In response, the sea calmed from its raging. Okay, so we have rabbis in the sea. We have all different kinds of fantastic stories about rabbis traveling. The Mediterranean, right? You have a nice picture down here of the port in Akko. Okay? The Mediterranean is called in our sources Hayam HaGadol, the Great Sea, right? The rabbis don't know about the Atlantic, they don't know about the Pacific. The Mediterranean is the huge sea for them. And it's a metaphor in Tanakh and later for infinity, for something that is so far away, right? What does Moshe say? The Torah is not me'aver layam. It's not across the sea. It's not unattainable, right? So the sea can be something great. There's a special bracha you say when you see the Mediterranean. The Romans called the Mediterranean Mare Nostrum, our sea, right? Our local sea. It's our sea. They are familiar with the Atlantic. And the Mediterranean, of course, is the sea that's in the middle of the lands, right? It's got the, the land of Israel on the eastern edge. It's got Africa in the south, right? It's in the middle of all the lands. So there's definitely a familiarity with the sea. But what's this place of Medina? Oh, sorry. Medinat Hayam, right? If you look at the English translation, the first mission I brought here, probably the most famous place where we talk about Medina Hayam, beginning of Masechet Gittin. I brought it to you in Hebrew because the English translation is just overseas, not necessarily the right translation. Hamevi get miMedinat Hayam. Okay, someone who brings a bill of divorce. Okay, this is a very interesting a divorce document, a get, can be brought by an agent, by a shaliach, but that agent has to say, I saw this written, I saw it signed. Okay, we'll get into why in a minute. Okay, now what is this place? Okay, so the translation here, the English translation says a country overseas. If you look at the very bottom, okay, the Rabbi Ovadia Mibatanura, the commentary of Rabbi Ovadia Bartanura on the Mishnah, maybe get me Medina Hayam, kol chutzalaretz kri Medina Hayam. Any place that's not Israel is Medina Hayam, which makes sense, right, from a lot of the things that we're going to read here. However, the fact of the Yam and the fact that Rabban Gamliel says, let's contrast the Medina Hayam to these places called Rekem and Cheger, which are in the desert, okay, to the east of Eretz Yisrael, makes us think that we're talking about places that are to the west of Eretz Yisrael, places that are across the sea, okay? Now, why do we need to have the shaliach, the messenger, say, I saw this written, I saw this signed? Gemara immediately asks that question. What is the reason for this declaration? Right, go back to our sources here. Rabbah says it's because the people who live overseas are not experts in writing a bill of divorce for her sake. Okay, fascinating. If you live in Medina Hayam, and this seems to preclude Babylonia, because Babylonia, they definitely know a lot. But this is places like Tarsus, like Cappadocia, where people don't know so much. They're not the experts. They don't know what to do. So they might not know that the get has to be written for this specific woman. They might go to the Judaica store and buy a get. No, you can't do that. You have to have someone who knows what they're doing, and he has to say, it was written in my presence, it was signed in my presence. That's Rabbah's answer. Rabbah says something else. No, says because there are no witnesses available to ratify it. Medina Hayam is far away, okay? So if you have some witness who's there, that doesn't help you once the get is brought to Eretz Yisrael, because I want to have a witness who says to me, yes, I saw this done. And if that guy is over there in Rome or in Tarsus, he's not going to help me, right? He's too far away. And that seems to be what's going on in these other references to Medina Hayam. It's far away. It's inaccessible. A woman went, she and her husband overseas. If there was peace between him and her and peace in the world, right? It's beautiful language in the Mishnah. They're not fighting and there's no war going on. And the woman came back by herself and said, my husband died, she may marry, right? We believe her because it's so far away that we can't get any other kind of testimony of corroboration. In the same thing, in the case of a husband who went overseas and someone arose and sustained his wife in his absence, the husbands are always going to Medina Hayam. Bye, honey. I'm off to Medina Hayam. And what's she going to do with herself? How's she going to make a living? She has to depend on him. Maybe left her money for 6 months. Maybe left her money for a year. But he is inaccessible. He's in this place where we can't even get letters to her. It's going to take a really long time. Someone else stepped in and said, I'll support you. Right. And the mission discusses when the husband returns, does he have to pay him back or not? Right. Interesting question. We won't go into it. Okay. Finally, somebody who comes from the Medina Hayam on Chol HaMoed. Okay. The idea is that he's traveling, and while he's traveling, he can't shave. He can't cut his hair. He can't do his laundry. Okay. And when he left, it was before Yom Tov, and so many days have passed, and he arrives on Chol HaMoed, we allow him to shave and cut his hair because he's had this very, very, very long journey. Okay, so Medina Hayam is a fascinating place. The truth is, I would love someone to write a really scholarly article about Medina Hayam. I have not found anything that really goes deeply to explain it. Okay, and our final place, and then we're actually going to go to money. Okay, and this is a place called Aspamia. This is the farthest place. It's the furthest of Medina Hayam. Okay, we don't hear about it so much, but we hear about it a little bit. Okay, in Bava Batra, right? If you've been doing the daf, so this came up not so long ago. Take a look at the first source here. Rabbi Yehuda says the sages said that establishing presumptive ownership, right, a chazaka, requires 3 years. Right, you could be on somebody's property. But, and then you can sort of lay claim to it, but only if you've been there for 3 years. Why? If the owner is in Aspamia and another possesses this field for a year, people will go and inform the owner by the end of the next year, and the owner will come back the following year. It's a full year's journey to get there, to find him. For him to come back is another year, meaning it's very, very far away. Okay. Another more colorful illustration of how far it is. Okay. This is the Gemara Nida. Okay. Where it talks about a dream, right? And I dreamed something, and we all know dreams can happen in all sorts of places. Do not wonder how one can see from one end of the world to the other in a dream, right? As a person can sleep here in this location and see a dream in Aspamia. And there's actually an expression in very like literate, beautiful Hebrew that says Chalomot ba'Aspamia. Chalomot ba'Aspamia literally means, it doesn't literally mean it, the corresponding metaphor in English is a pipe dream, right? Something that's, oh, I dreamed that I was in Aspamia, I was so far away, right? Someplace that's very far away. Now here we have in the Avamos also very far away. All the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him, right? Avraham. indicates that even ships that come from Gallia to Espana, and here the translation that I put here gives you a hint what we're talking about, are blessed only due to the Jewish people. Okay, where is this Espana? So this Gemara in Yavama gave it away. Espana seems to be the Hebrew way of saying Hispania. Hispania, of course, is Spain, right? Hispania, Espana, Spain, it's the same thing. We know that there are Jews that are there already from Second Temple times. The Jews from Spain have a tradition that they go back already to Galut Bayit Rishon, right? To the exile from the First Temple. The Spanish Jews were really considered to be the aristocracy of Jews, and I brought you this picture up here from a synagogue in Nachlaot, in Jerusalem. It says Agudat Beit Knesset Chesed Barachamim La'adat Hasfaradim, to the ethnicity of the Sfaradim. And if you see the parentheses here, it says Samech Tet Sfaradi Tahor. You're a pure Sephardi. If you can trace your lineage back to the real Sephardi in Spain, that's the aristocracy of the Jewish people. Okay, fascinating, right? It's very interesting. Why is this name Hispania? So we have a nice, cute little legend. The first settlers that come to Hispania are Phoenician traders, and when they get off their ships, they see all kinds of rabbits and the urban legend is that Hispania comes from Ishpanim, the island of the rabbits. Don't take that with a lot of grains of salt. Very cute idea, but I don't know. But if you know Hebrew, you know that today in Hebrew, we don't call Spain Aspamia. We call it Sfarad, right? Where does that word come from? It doesn't have anything to do with this nice Latin name of Hispania. And that comes from the Book of Ovadia. Okay. Book of Ovadia, shortest book in the Tanakh, right? And it says, and I brought you here in Hebrew, Begalut Hachel Hazel Ibn Israel Asher Knaanim Ad Sorfat, Begalut Yushalayim Asher Bisfarad, Yeshu et Arei HaNegev. Right? The exiles of the Israelite that belongs to the Phoenicians as far as Sorfat. Well, the Jerusalem exile community of Sfarad shall possess the towns of the Negev. Now, Ovadia is living in First Temple times. He is not talking about what we say is Tzarfat, which is France, and what we say is Sfarad is Spain. But already by Second Temple times, right? Targum Yonatan, look on the bottom there. Galut Ama Haden Dibnei Yisrael Diba'ara Knana Ad Tzarfat. He doesn't translate Tzarfat. The Galut Yerushalayim Dibe'aspamya. Okay, already by second, late, by rabbinic times, okay, Espana and Sfarad are connected to each other. Okay, is this what Ovadia meant? No, this is not what Ovadia meant, most likely. What did Ovadia mean? He probably meant a different Jewish community, which is also very important, significant Jewish community, and that's a Jewish community in Sardis, okay? Another Asia Minor community. Jews have been there already from the 3rd century before the Common Era, and it was a place that would have been known to Ovadia, maybe not as a Jewish community, but as a place, right? It's not so far away from Eretz Yisrael. This is a picture here on the right of the synagogue that was discovered in Sardis, which had many, many Greek and Hebrew inscriptions, and it's a very interesting place. So Sfarad is probably Sardis, but today we say Sfarad for Spain, but really we should probably say Espana. Okay. We are coming home to Eretz Israel, and we are going to talk about some money. Okay. Up until now, we really tried to differentiate with Bavel, with Eretz Israel, with different places in the diaspora. Most of what we're going to talk about now is Eretz Israel. Eretz Israel is ruled by the Romans, and so we're going to talk about Roman money and the Jewish versions of Roman money. We might put in a little something else, but mostly we're going to talk about the Roman monetary system. We have a lot of money in the Mishnah, in the Gemara. There's a lot of discussion of payment, whether it's for a ketubah, whether it's for damages, all different kinds of things that money comes up. Sometimes, like we said, using the Roman system, sometimes using the Jewish system. Just very, very briefly before we start, coins come only in Persian times and later to the Jewish people, maybe slightly earlier in other places, but there are no coins in biblical times. There are no coins in First Temple times. Okay, when we talk about the half shekel that's given to Moshe or with Nehemiah, it's not a coin. It's a weight of silver. It's a hunk of money, right? When Avram buys Marat HaMachpelah, he doesn't take out 400 shekel coins. He takes out a hunk of silver or maybe a few hunks of silver that weigh, right? What does the word shekel come from? Shekel, mishkal, it's a weight. Okay. Coins show up in the Persian period, Shivat Zion. Coins themselves are fascinating, right? A coin is except for an inscription or maybe equivalent to an inscription, probably the best thing an archaeologist can find because coins tell you a whole story, right? Coins have dates, coins have pictures, coins have symbols. So coins are super, super useful, and we're always very happy to find them. Okay. With that said, coins can be confusing. Okay. So take a look at this nice chart here of Roman denominations, but even these changed in different time periods. So for example, the aureus, like the most valuable coin here, the gold coin here, okay, at some point it became known as a solidus. Their weights changed. You could have good mints, you could have bad mints. Okay, we're not going to go into so many of these things, but let's try to understand a little bit. Okay, skip the first source up here and look at the bottom source. Okay, and there are other charts online, and I have to say I'm not a math person, so bear with me. I wrote it out for me because I get confused. Okay, so in the Roman system, one denarius, okay, over here, this handsome fellow, okay, denarius might sound similar to what we talk about, which is a dinar. Hold on, we'll get to that. One denarius is worth 16 as, and as is bigger, but it is worth much less, okay? In the Jewish system, we adopt the word, right? We say a dinar, but we also have another word for it called a zuz. And that's not 16 as, it's 24 isar. Okay, so an isar is a coin that's like an as, but not exactly. Okay, one isar is worth 8 prutot. A pruta is the smallest amount that you could possibly have. Okay, we find a lot of prutot in archaeological excavations because think about it. If you drop your coin purse, you're going to pick up the quarters, you're going to pick up the silver dollars. You're not going to bother with the penny that rolled under the couch because nobody cares about pennies, right? So that's the same thing here. People didn't bother necessarily to pick up their pennies unless they were very poor, and so we find a lot of them. Okay, let's just continue with our money and our equivalents, right? 192 prutot equal 1 dinar. Okay, now we'll come back to the mana in a minute, but take a look at this Gemara in Kiddushin. It might make you mad, but it's actually a halachic principle that's at work here. Beit Shammai says we're talking about being mekadesh a woman, right? If you are to betroth a woman, you have to give her money or what's called shaveh kesef, something that's worth money. Today we do rings, but that's a relatively recent thing. Okay. Beit Shammai says she can be acquired with 1 dinar or anything that is worth 1 dinar. Okay, that's a respectable sum. It's not a huge amount of money, but it's respectable. Beit Hillel says she can be acquired with 1 pruta or with anything that is worth 1 pruta. What? Beit Hillel, come on. How can you be worth 1 pruta? That's a ridiculous thing, right? But it's not, because what Beit Shammai is saying is that it has to have actual money. This is an actual purchase. Whereas Beit Hillel is saying, oh, this is a symbolic purchase. And just handing over that 1 pruta, that's enough to affect a kinyan, a purchase, right? And Beit Hillel actually wins because we know that something that is shaveh pruta, right, that's worth a pruta, which is worth very little, is something that has value in the Jewish legal system. If it's less than a pruta, then already there's nothing to talk about. But shaveh pruta, that has some kind of symbolic value. Beit Shammai says, no, that's not honorable for a Jewish woman. It has to be something more. Okay, let's just do one more equivalence and then try to see where we use some of this money. Okay, go back to our little list here. Okay, so remember we had our dinar, which was worth 192 prutot. 100 dinar or 100 zuzim is worth one mane. Okay? Why do we care? Because, okay, relative value. We all know about Chad Gadya. Chad Gadya didah bin abba bitrei zuze. Right? One nice goat could be bought for two zuz. Let's just go back for a second. Right? Two zuz or two dinar. Okay? That's okay, a respectable amount of money. According to Shammai, you could get two wives for that, but okay. But a ketubah for a woman is, if it's her first marriage, she's a bitulah, is two maneh, which equals 200 zuz. Okay, so that's just to give us a little bit of a sense of relative value. So while the woman, the kinyan, the kiddushin can be affected with very little money, but her ketubah, what she gets when the marriage is over, okay, that is actually a significant sum of 200 zuz, of one month, of two maneh. This beautiful ketubah was drawn by my daughter for my son's wedding. Anyone who wants to order a ketubah, be in touch. Okay, like we said, coins teach us a lot, right? Coins are very, very useful to us. So I brought us two examples, okay? Two subjects. Okay? Coins can teach us about Jewish sovereignty, okay? So what we have here, the first two coins, the one on the left and the one in the middle, these are coins from Hasmonean kings. Okay, the first coin all the way on the left is from a king named Yochanan Hyrcanus, John Hyrcanus, the son of Shimon HaChashmonai. Okay, and you can see it's very interesting decorations. On one side of the coin, it has writing. The writing is in the Ktav Ivri, in the old Hebrew writing. Now, by the time of Yochanan Hyrcanus, Jews are writing in the Ktav Ashuri, in the new square writing that we use today. Okay, why would they put the old writing on coins? Because it's meant to be, let's go back to those glory days of David and Solomon, right? That's the idea, even though there were no coins in the time of David and Solomon. Okay, so that's on one side. What does it say? Yochanan Kohen Gadol, right? Yochanan Hyrcanus was a Kohen Gadol, like the other Chashmonaim. The Chaver Hayudim, he's the head of the Council of Jews. What's on the other side? You have two different things, right? And what people choose to put on their coins really says something about them. Jews did not put pictures of themselves on their coins, right? Remember the Roman coins, they're always going to be of Roman emperors. But Jews, or not always, but often, Jews did not do that because we don't like images. But what did they put? They put two things here. One is this nice cornucopia. Okay, a cornucopia is a classic Hellenistic symbol, right? Horn of plenty. We still use it today. You can find it on Roman statues of the goddess Tyche, right? The goddess of the city. Oh, plenty, fertility, overflowing, right? Very nice Hellenistic symbol. What's in the middle? I know it doesn't look like this, but it's hard to make a coin. This is a pomegranate. This is a rimon, classic Jewish symbol. Okay, this gives us a little bit of an insight into our Chashmonai kings who like to have it all, right? They're very Hellenized, but they also want to have Jewish writing, Jewish symbols. Interesting. Now, the coin in the middle, much less bifurcated. This is the coin of Matityahu Antigonus, who is the final Chashmonai king. And what does he put here? He has a menorah. Yes, this is from the first century before the Common Era. This is one of the earliest depictions of the menorah that we have. And it's use, it's copied today on modern Israeli Ten Agorot coin. So that's a lot of our coins today are copies of older coins. And finally, on the right, we have a coin that was found at Gamla in the Golan. Okay, and this is going to lead us in a minute to coins of Jewish rebels. Okay, the Jewish rebels made coins because having coinage, having money shows sovereignty, right? Today too. And what did they put on their coin? On both sides, they had writing, which together spelled out, Legi'ulat Yerushalayim HaKdosha, for the redemption of Holy Jerusalem. Gamla is far in the north, in the Golan. But what's their priority? Why are they rebelling in the Great Revolt in the year 67 of the Common Era? They're rebelling for Jerusalem. Okay? We also have coins that are from the Romans, or here's another rebel coin, but let's look at the Roman coins first. Okay, the one on the top left is probably the most famous Roman coin for Jews, and that's the coin that says Judaea Capta. Okay, this is a coin that the Romans put out after they conquered Jerusalem and destroyed the temple, right? Vespasian, Titus, the year 70, a very evocative coin, Judaea Capta. Judea has been captured. A Roman soldier standing tall and proud next to a palm tree. Palm trees were also symbol of the land of Israel, and sitting bent over crying, we have a Jewish woman, right? So the Roman soldier, male, powerful conqueror, the Jew, female, subject, right, weeping. By the way, State of Israel in 1958, 10th anniversary of the State of Israel, put out a coin called Israel Liberata, which showed the same palm tree in the middle, but with two figures both standing, one on either side, a man and a woman, chalutzim, pioneers, right? It's a beautiful coin. On the bottom, we have another coin that also expresses a very, very traumatic event in Jewish history. And this is a coin that shows the plowing. This is the Emperor Hadrian. Okay. And this is the plowing. You can see the person and you can see the ox and the furrow. And this is the creation of the city of Aelia Capitolina. Okay. This is when Jerusalem is destroyed by the Romans.
Hello.
And they plow it, and that's a very symbolic thing for the Romans. When you plow, you are creating a new city. The
Oh,
Jews, of course, take this to the prophecy of Micha, Tzion Tzadeh
good.
Teherash. But this is showing how the Romans are creating this new city of Aelia Capitolina. Right? On the right, we have Jewish response. Okay, this is one of the coins that we have from the Bar Kokhba revolt. Bar Kokhba revolt lasts 3 years, according to some scholars, longer than that. And they're actually able to mint coins, usually taking existing coins, right, and making their own coins on top of them, as a way of showing kind of a rebellion against the Roman system. And also, it's cheaper. You don't have to have your own, you don't have to have your own silver. But this is a great coin, right? This is a Bar Kokhba coin, and both sides are really interesting. First of all, you can see the Hebrew writing. Right, Hebrew writing again is those old letters. Let's go back to the good old days. But the pictures are what's really very interesting here. You have the facade of the Beit HaMikdash, and this is actually the only depiction, contemporary depiction of what the Beit HaMikdash looked like. Meaning, the time of Bar Kokhba, the Beit HaMikdash is no longer standing, but people had seen it. It's not so long after the destruction of the temple. So you have the facade of the temple, and inside, what we think is the Aron, right, with the Badim, with the two handles, right, protruding out of it, which of course they had not seen because it didn't appear anymore in the Second Temple. But it's a utopian kind of a portrayal. The other side is maybe even more interesting. What do you got here? Classic Jewish symbol, lulav, right? Really the Arba Minim, three here, and the etrog on the side here. But what's fascinating about this is that you have one lulav. Fine, we always have one lulav. You have one hadas and one arava instead of what we have today, right? And what the rabbis talk about, which is three and three, three and four. Now, it could be, like I said, it's hard to make things on coins. Maybe, the guy gave up and said, I'm only doing one of each. Or maybe, and this I think is a fascinating suggestion, although I'm not sure it's true. Who's Bar Kokhba's Rebbe? Who proclaims Bar Kokhba as the Messiah? Rebbe Akiva. Whose approach in the Mishnah says you only need to have one of each of the Minim? Rebbe Akiva. Right? So is Rebbe Akiva being followed here by Bar Kokhba when they're minting this coin? Maybe, right? It's actually a fascinating idea. Again, I'm not 100% sure it's true, but I think it's very interesting. Okay, one of the most important coins in temple times is the half shekel, right? The machatzit ha-shekel. Okay? We are commanded in the Torah to go to Jerusalem, right? Aliyah LaRegel, three times a year. There is no way that people outside of Jerusalem, and perhaps lots of people inside Jerusalem also, came three times a year. Too far, too close together, too complicated. So in Israel, maybe you would try to come once, twice a year. Outside of Israel, chances are good you went once or twice in your lifetime, right? But you want to be part of the Beit HaMikdash. So what do? You give the Machatzit HaShekel tax. Every male is supposed to give their Machatzit HaShekel. And these are collected from all over and brought to Jerusalem. Okay, so first you set up all over the place counters where people would bring their money and exchange it for this half shekel coin. We'll get to that in a minute. But first, let's understand this idea of the collection. All right, the Mishnah in Shkalim on the 15th of Adar, money changers would sit at tables set up in the rest of the country outside the temple to handle the collection of shekels, right? What's the beginning of the pilgrimage season? Pesach. So a month before Pesach, you start to collect. On the 25th of Adar, the money changers sat in the temple. Okay, so you would collect your money and then you would send it with some emissary up to Jerusalem, whether you're sending it from the Galil or you're sending it from Babylonia or you're sending it from Aspamia, right? You're sending it to Jerusalem. And the Mishnah actually goes on and says, well, what if the shaliach is robbed on the way? Who's responsible? Does he have to pay, right? This is a very interesting question. Okay. Once the money gets there, what do you do with it? Okay, you would put it into these collection horns. Just as there were collection horns in the temple, there were collection horns in the rest of the country, right? So they would collect and they would send it, and then it was used for the public sacrifices, for the korbanot tzibur. Okay, how much is this machatzit shekel? Gemara goes into a whole long discussion, but basically 2 dinar, 384 prutot. Go back to your sources and understand how that is. Okay, most of the time the money makes it to the Beit HaMikdash. Sometimes it doesn't. Okay? The picture on the bottom is a hoard of coins that was discovered in Usafia. Usafia is in the Carmel near Haifa. Today it's a Druze town, a very important Druze town. But in the time of Second Temple, it was a Jewish town. An excavation that was done there in 1960 uncovered 4,000 shekels and half shekels. Why? Okay, so one suggestion is that they were going, they gathered up this money. It was in the years 67, 68, 69, right? Whatever it was. And it was too hard to come. There was a war going on, right? We all know how that is. And then they heard that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. You can't give the money back. The money is consecrated. What are you going to do with the money? They buried it. That's the suggestion of what this money is. Now, there's a value to the half shekel. But you had to bring your 384 prutot and exchange them for a specific coin. Okay, why? Because as we said in the beginning, some mints are good, some mints are worse, right? Some mints they water down the money, right? And the mint that's considered to be the best mint in the time of the Beit HaMikdash is the mint in Tyre. Okay, in Phoenicia. And the Gemara says here in Bechora, Rabbi Yehuda says it, Rav Asi says, every sum of money stated in the Torah is referring to silver dinars of Tyrian coinage. Coinage, shekel tzori, which is very interesting because shekel tzori didn't exist in the time of the Torah, but we're not going to go there. Okay, now it's fascinating if you look at it because it's got a picture of a god on one side, of an eagle on the other side. These are not exactly super Jewish symbols, but yet this was the coin that was used, that was brought to the Beit HaMikdash. This is the Machatzit HaShekel that people come and they bring. It also tells us, and this is just something to keep in mind, is important to understand, that the temple was a vast bank. There is lots and lots and lots of money in the temple. Okay? There's lots of potential for money, as in you can get the contract for the olive oil or for the sacrifices or for the wood. There's also lots of actual money. When the Romans conquer the temple, destroy the temple, they're looking for money because there is lots of money there. Okay, so that's just something to keep in your mind. Okay, we're going to move on from money. I mean, we're still going to talk about money, but not about coins. And here we're going to talk about a very important guy who in modern Hebrew is called a chalfan, but in Mishneic Hebrew is called a shulchani. Okay, and shulchani is actually a much more useful word. It actually comes from the Greek word, which is a trapezite. which comes from the Greek word tetrapez, which is a table. Okay? Even today, when you go to a money changer, wherever you're going, whether it's in Kikartsion or it's in the airport, what is the main accoutrement of the money changer? There's a counter, right? Usually there's a window and there's a counter. Money changer doesn't need a lot to set up shop. This is a great picture here of a money changer in Tel Aviv in the 30s and the 1940s. I don't remember exactly what it was, but you don't need a lot. You need a table. That's pretty much what you need. And that's what you needed in the old days too. Okay. So this is the Shulchani. The Shulchani could also have a table that could be folded down, right? He wasn't always sitting there. And maybe he was out in the marketplace and couldn't take up that space. So you had a table that would fold up and hang on a nail. Okay, so take a look at the second source here. It's talking about all kinds of vessels and utensils that are pure or impure. A masmer shel shulchani, a money changer's nail. Is clean, Rabbi Tzadok says, no, it's susceptible to impurity. This is the nail that he hangs up his folding table on. Okay, so what does the Shulchani do? What's his job? So you're looking above Mitzia, right? The Mishnah says, Hamafkid ma'ot etzel ha-Shulchani. You give your money to the Shulchani to hold on to. Okay, so the Shulchani does a bunch of things. He, the most obvious, the one that we know the best, is he exchanges foreign currency, right? People come from all over, they need the local currency, he exchanges foreign currency. He also gives change, right? I have a very big coin, I want smaller coins, you bring it to him, or vice versa, right? He changes in your whatever it was, 392 prutot for your half shekel. Okay. But he also can hold on to your money. He can be a bank. That's this Mishnah in Bava Metzia. I'm a maot. We don't have banks in the old days, right? So he's holding on to your money. He can transfer, and when he holds on, sorry, when he holds on to your money, he can, just like a bank today, he can use that money. You need to get your money back, but it doesn't have to be your money. It has to be money, right? So take a look here. The Gemara goes on. If the money is bound, the money changer may not use it. You bring him your special gold coins that you inherited from your grandmother. You don't want him to use that money. You tie it up. But if you just bring him some money, okay, then the money is unbound. The money changer may use it. And if it is lost, he bears responsibility for it. Okay? So he can take your money. He can invest it. He can make more money, just like banks do today. But he has to return the same sum of money that you gave it to him. Okay. Another way, right, in the world before PayBox and Venmo, you want to be able to transfer money. That's not so easy to do. Okay, so you have your Shulchani, he does that for you. The money, one who owes money transferred his payment by leaving instructions with a storekeeper or a money changer to pay him. Now, this is actually fascinating because Greeks and Romans, and through them, Jews, came up with very sophisticated financial tools, which are largely forgotten in the Middle Ages. Okay, but the Jews are holding on to them. And these are ways really to keep an economy going. Now, some people didn't like this. In the New Testament, right, we have a very famous scene of Jesus overturning the tables of the money changers. Right? He says, my house will be called a house of prayer. You are making it a den of robbers. But he's getting the story wrong, meaning, yes, there is corruption in the Beit HaMikdash, and that is a very, very terrible thing. However, the money changers are not the source of it. The money changers are making it possible for people to pay their half shekel, for the korbanot to be given, for the whole thing to work. Right? The fact that there is corruption and there is theft and there is skimming off the top, yes, that is bad, but it's not the fault of the money changers necessarily. Okay? One last thing that the money changer does, because he works a lot with coins, so he understands the value, right? And I think it's hard for us to understand today because, a dollar is a dollar, a shekel is a shekel. I mean, yes, they do have relative value, but we assume that all dollars are uniform, all shekels are uniform. But as we saw a minute ago, in ancient world, some mints are good, some mints are bad, some coins are better than other coins. And the Shulchani's job is to know which coins are good, right? You bring him your coins and you say to him, what do I have here? He's like an appraiser, right? Like for jewelry. He'll tell you what you have, what's valuable, what you can do with it. And that's where you got this beautiful Gemara in Sanhedrin, right? Part of this whole story about Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, Rabbi Elazar HaGadol, who we mentioned before, who's put into cherem, and he has so much Torah, and he's not able to teach it because the rabbis have to stay away from him. And they finally go to him on his deathbed, and he says, "My arms are like two rolled up Torah scrolls. I have so much Torah to give, and nobody to give it to." And then the rabbis hear that he dies. And Rabbi Akiva, you know, is very upset, and he does kriya, and he says, he quotes from the Book of Kings, Elisha, when he sees Eliyahu being carried up in the chariot of fire, and he says, my father, the chariot of Israel and its horsemen, right? Rechav Yisrael v'parasha. But then Rabbi Akiva adds his own part, right? Harbe ma'ot yeshli, I have many coins, but I do not have a money changer to whom to give them. Rabbi Akiva says, I have Torah. I have a lot of Torah, but I need you, Rabbi Elazar, to tell me what my Torah is worth and how to use my Torah and how to teach my Torah. And it's really, I think, a very powerful metaphor. So that's our Shulchani. That's our change guy. Okay, we're going to have time for a little bit more money. Okay, we have a very interesting phrase about money, which is something called a kaspata. Okay, Baba Kama, right? A story about you know, somebody who did not protect something properly, a certain man who kicked a kaspita, which is translated here as a safe, belonging to another, sending it in a river. Okay, what's a kaspita? A kaspita is a place to keep your kesef. Okay, kesef, of course, is money or silver. So today we have the modern Hebrew word kasefet. It's the same thing. Okay, we have a very modern Hebrew word called a kaspomat, right, which is a combination of kesef and otomat. Kaspomat is your ATM, right? It's a great word. But here we have a kaspita. Okay, now this is something that's known in the ancient world. Romans had an equivalent. They called it an arca, a treasure chest, the same root as an ark. Okay, you have a nice picture of one here. You also could have an arca publica, right? Community funds could be kept in this community treasure chest. So you could have your own kaspita at home that you kept your money in. But we also have a different kind of treasure, and this is why I brought you this picture here. We find under a bunch of synagogues in Eretz Yisrael, hoards of coins, right? Remember at the very beginning of the class, I showed you a hoard of coins from Wadi Hammam. Hey, until now, there have been more than 20 synagogues from Ein Gedi in the south to Golan in the north, mostly the Galil and the Golan, where we found coin hoards under the floors of synagogues. Now, that's actually really awesome because, again, remember, what's so great about coins? They're dated, right? And it's always very hard to date synagogues unless you have an inscription that says this year this was built. But otherwise, it's hard because we have different styles in different places, and it's not always easy to know when synagogues were made. So the picture here you have is of the reconstruction of the very beautiful Beit Knesset in Kfar Nahum, Capernaum, on the Kinneret, which when it was uncovered, archaeologists assumed it was a second century CE synagogue. It looks like other buildings from that time period. But then they uncovered this coin hoard, which had coins from the fourth and the fifth century. You can't have coins from the fifth century under the floor of a second century synagogue, right? It doesn't make sense. How would they have gotten those coins in the time machine? Okay, so coins are very useful to us, but you also have to say, well, why did they do this? So there's a very interesting woman. Her name is Dr. Teen Rasal. She's written the whole doctorate. She actually put it all online, where she examined all of these coin hoards from various places and tons of information. Very interesting. And she has a bunch of suggestions why you would do such a thing, right? One suggestion is the community needs emergency money, right? You never know what's going to happen, war, famine, something. We're going to put a bunch of money underneath the floorboards where people can get to it when it's needed, all right? That's one suggestion. Another suggestion, charity, all right? We want to have a charity fund from the whole community, want to keep it safe, we put it underneath, okay? Another suggestion, which she rejects, but which is an interesting suggestion, something called a foundation deposit, okay? Now, anyone who's built a house or done renovations in Israel has actually seen this if you have Arab workers. The idea is that you put something valuable in the foundation of the house. I've seen this myself when we redid our bathroom in our old house. The contractor took a 200 shekel note out of his wallet and put it into the mortar before he put the tiles on my new bathroom. And we said, what are you doing? He said, no, it's a limazal. It's for good luck. Right? And this is done. Right? Now, she rejects this. She says it's not likely that this was done in Bate Knesset. In synagogues, we have no inscriptions to talk about this. We have no halachot to talk about it. She doesn't think it's likely. But her most intriguing suggestion is that this money is money that was Maser Sheni money, right? Now, we know that we have a 7-year cycle with Shemitah, and you're also supposed to give money to the poor. And in 2 of those 7 years, you are supposed to give what's called Maser Sheni, which means you take a tenth of your produce, you transform it into money, and you bring it to Jerusalem, and you spend that money in Jerusalem. You buy a nice dinner, right? You take out all your friends. What do you do with that money when the temple is no longer standing? Okay. That's a big problem because we have Jews living in the land of Israel for many centuries after the temple is no longer standing. And for a long time, they're taking that maaser money. What do you do with it? You can't use it. It's consecrated. You can't take it to Jerusalem. What do? You put it in a geniza. You put it in a place where it's not going to be touched underneath the floor. And that's our suggestion. I think it's a great suggestion. It's fascinating. We are going to do one more. Okay, that is taxes. And we'll get to weights and measures next time. Okay, taxes. Everybody hates taxes. Okay, the Mishnah talks about one may take a vow to haragim or haramim, or tax collectors, that the produce in his possession is truma, although it is not truma. What's going on? Haragim, haramim, are they like thieves? According to Zev Safrai, there are different kinds of tax collectors. What are you allowed to do according to the Mishnah? You're allowed to lie. You're allowed to say that your produce is truma, even though it's not truma, because you know that the tax collectors are not going to take your truma. Really? You're allowed to lie, right? And the Gemara goes on. But we have the famous law of Shmuel, right? Dina de Malchuta Dina. Remember Shmuel last time? Naharda. The law of the land is the law. How can you cheat the tax collector, right? So now we've learned that there are two kinds of tax collectors. Rav Chinana said that Rav Kahana said that Shmuel said the Mishnah is referring to a tax collector who has no fixed amount. Okay? What does that mean, a tax collector who has no fixed amount? You have something called a tax farmer. Okay. You would auction off the rights to collect taxes among people who would bid. And one guy would say, okay, I can bring in $10 in taxes. And the other guy says, I can bring in $20 in taxes. The highest bidder is going to win. He can collect as much money as he can squeeze out of that region and those people. Whatever he gets more than what he owes to the authorities, he gets to keep. That's a tax collector with no fixed amount. You can understand why people did not like tax collectors, right? They are rapacious. They are greedy. Right? Look at this Gemara in Sanhedrin, right? A man, as when a man flees from a lion and a bear met him and went into the house and leaned his arm on the wall and the snake bit him, right? A pasuk from Amos. A man goes out to the field and is accosted by a guard who demands payment, right? Then he enters the city, is accosted by a tax collector, right? One after another, people are just taking money from them right and left. And that's why the collectors of taxes and customs officials were not disqualified at first, because the sages assumed they would take the set amount. When they realized these officials were taking more than that, they disqualified them. So tax collectors are not allowed to be witnesses. Tax collectors are not allowed to, we can't take their money for charity. These are bad people because they are stealing from people all the time. One may not exchange large coins for smaller ones from the trunk of the customs collector or the purse of tax collectors, and one may not take charity from them. Okay, very, very strict laws, but these guys were really disliked by everybody. On the side here, you have a particular tax, which is called the fiscus. This is a coin that was for something called the fiscus judaicus. Okay, a special tax put on the Jews, a very cruel Roman turn. What they did is once the temple was destroyed, they knew Jews were not giving the half shekel coin to the temple anymore. They said, oh, that money, that's going to go to us. Fiscus Judaicus, special tax on the Jews right after the destruction of the temple. So very terrible thing that the Romans did. Okay, we are going to stop here. We will do weights and measures next time. Let's see if we have questions here. Okay, Asia Minor had a more diverse population. That's true in ancient times, definitely. And Greeks, and we have Jews who go there from Spain and all sorts of things. How long would it take from Cappadocia to Israel? I didn't do my usual trick of doing Google mapping it, and you would have to go by sea, but I would say 2 weeks, a week, 2 weeks, not as long as you would think. Okay. Okay. Argentinian peso. I don't know how that came up. If the coins are stored in the synagogue for use and they could be placed there many years after the synagogue is built. This is true. And this whole question of dating is also more complicated than I presented it. So thank you for pointing that out. That is a good point. Okay. Last class, I am not the uploader, so don't ask me. That has to go to Torah in Motion.
Can you please ask them? Because I also missed
it. Send them an email.
Oh, okay.
Send them an email. Always a good idea. Yes, not all currencies are stable or valuable. This is true. I didn't say all currencies are stable. My point was that all shekel coins have the same amount of silver. Maybe I didn't make that so clear, right? We assume that they are uniform and all dollars are made out of the same paper, meaning dollars doesn't matter, but coins, it actually does matter. So that's what I meant. But yes, currencies definitely fluctuate very wildly. Okay. Thank you, everyone. This should be a week of Besorot Tovot. And everyone should have a Shabbat Shalom. And I will see you all next week.